the perspective of, or in the light of Mark's gospel, just to tell you a moment's worth of who I am, because I didn't do that at the first session. I have two hats that I wear professionally. One is I'm the Washington, D.C. representative of the Center for Global Education, an organization housed at Augsburg College in Minnesota, and we do travel seminars and semester programs to many different parts of the globe. My work has been mostly in Central America. And second, I'm the co-director of a small collective of writers and trainers that do work with Christian people facing, addressing social justice issues. And the Columbus Quincentenary has been a very important issue to me in the past couple of years. I need to take just a couple of minutes to briefly review what we covered yesterday, but to help me know how much to do that, how many people here were here yesterday in this session? Four. Okay. We'll take a couple of minutes to go over yesterday, and then I have a question I would like to ask you, and then we'll dig into some information about 500 years ago and about today. And then at the end, we're going to look at a text in Mark, and then hopefully have some time to do some application of that text to today. So that's a brief outline of what we'll do today. Yesterday, basically, we opened with a question of why critically examine the Columbus Quincentenary. And good. I said that. Right. You never know what it'll be in this session. I said that to me, the Quincentenary, the story of Columbus is not about Columbus primarily. It's about us. It's about us and how we relate to people and how we relate to nations. To me, it's an enormously rich opportunity because I think that understanding how we learn about Columbus and what we believe about Columbus is key to enabling us to address issues of grave and agonizing social injustice today, to address the arms race, to address homelessness, to address poverty, to address ecological destruction. Understanding the way we think about Columbus is key to that, I believe, key to us building a more humane and compassionate future. We looked at slides yesterday of textbooks, children's textbooks and biographies of Christopher Columbus and his coming to the Americas, and we looked at how those convey Columbus in, I think you could easily say, a very, very, very biased way. In other words, Columbus was always seen as good and noble. We knew Columbus from childhood on up through these textbooks, pictures of him, pictures of his boyhood, which is not factually based. No one knows about Columbus's boyhood. And the Indians were portrayed as, in many cases, non-existent, but in other cases, ignorant, inarticulate, uncultured, uncivilized, savage, pagan, heathen, etc. So the slides were illustrative of how we begin to learn history. I would like to ask you one question and just have some quick responses. I'd like to know why you're here. If you can, maybe one way of getting at that would be to name a question or a curiosity that's in your mind related to the Columbus Quincentenary. You want to just go around and throw out quick responses to that?
I'm confused about why we've been lied to.
Okay.
I feel like I've been lied to.
Okay.
I don't have a quick response to that.
Okay.
My wife and I coordinate our adult forum, and I know our synod assembly said that we were to do the repent, renew emphasis. And so I was just looking for material and remember repent.
Okay. Thank you. That reminds me that everyone, are most people here Lutherans? Lutherans should know that not only your synod assembly, but the National Churchwide Assembly in Orlando passed a resolution declaring this year a year of remembrance, repentance, and renewal concerning the Quincentenary, and gave directives on examining issues of poverty and racism, examining history and the way we learn it, and I have copies of that in the blue folder back there. You can't take them but you could and keep them, but you could borrow them. Go ahead.
I'm just interested in historical type issues.
Okay.
Yeah, and I don't know much about it at all, so basically any information would be probably
okay. All right.
just got here today, relaxing and listening.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's fine. That's fine. Okay.
Same thing.
All right. Over here.
I have just more information and curiosity. I was brought up that Columbus discovered America, and that's what I know.
So. Okay. If we had more time, I'd like to spend an hour on that question, just all of us digging into when we first heard about Columbus and what we learned. But think about that question.
Just more perspective.
Okay.
I was here last week, so I wanted to, I didn't get to everything last week, so I wanted to pick up.
Okay.
One of the things that occurs to me is that Columbus, in order to have been remembered at all, must have done something that was at least somewhat admirable or heroic, and it seems to me maybe that we should remember him as a sailor that that dared to explore past the edge of the boundaries that most people had gone to. But how he got involved in this other exploitation and the myth that goes along with that is beyond me.
So okay. Okay. I hear that.
I'd just like to hear more about the information that's coming to light. I mean, we've always thought of Columbus as a great guy, and all this information is really interesting.
Okay. I think that's true. We have always thought of Columbus as a great guy. Mm. Yeah. It was interesting to me to ask, I asked a group of people the question of, what did you first learn about Columbus? And many people digging into what we first learned said similar to that, the great guy. And there were some Native Americans in the group. And the words that they came out with were murderer and imperialist. And it was just a striking contrast. And they didn't do that in an angry, defiant way at the white people in the group, but that was what they had.
Something in regards to this information coming out, I'm from Southern California, where on New Year's Day we had a Rose Parade. And for the Grand Marshal, they was inviting a descendant of Columbus. And you know, the Indians there in Los Angeles, they objected very strenuously because they didn't like the idea at all.
That's a good piece of input. Let's see if this session can help us understand that objection. Okay.
I was in a whole language class a month ago, and one of the topics of discussion was how much we knew about Columbus.
I see.
And then we realized how little we really knew.
I see.
A few people had something. Even one theory came out. Someone had been told that Columbus had been a Christian on bath.
I see.
So,
interesting.
I mean, we heard every range of description of it.
Okay. Columbus actually ran his ship. He was accompanied by Franciscans and ran the Christian or the Franciscan daily ritual, religious ritual on the ship. Yes.
Well, I read more and more as I get older what happened. But even as children, we learned the cruelty of the Spaniards to everyone, not only as they came to America, wherever they went. However, when you think of that man coming across the Atlantic in three little teacups, that, I don't know, maybe it was luck. As far as being heroic, that voyage probably was. You're right, not one of us would even board the ship unless it was tied to the harbor.
Okay, so bringing out
but
maybe
the horrible cruelty, even as children, we got that in school. All through the...
Where'd you go to school?
All the Spanish explorers.
Yeah, I never heard that. The Spaniards, it seems like they didn't mention Columbus, but it was the Spaniards when they treated the Indians.
Interesting. That's an interesting comment because even in the face of hearing that the Spaniards may have been cruel, Columbus was not included in that circle of cruelty. In other words, our hero needed to remain pure. One of the things we did last week was look at a painting, and there are innumerable paintings. It was just a marvelous exhibit in the National Museum of American Art on the westward movement, including the coming of Columbus, and almost invariably, Columbus was extraordinarily noble, and not just noble, but almost a man of God, you know, in the rhetorical sense. The light of God shining on him, his face clean and pure, and the Spaniards that accompanied him might be groveling in the dirt or fighting with the Indians, but Columbus was bowing and he had the cross. And so that's an interesting comment that you just made, that though we may have learned about the cruelty of the Spaniards, what did we learn about Columbus, and who do we identify with?
It was more or less old world cruelty. The Spaniards were not the only ones who were cruel. It was a form of life. They were cruel to their own people.
Good, thank you. Let's move on a couple more. Just the question that brings you here, or a question that brings you here.
I wandered in and was startled and fascinated yesterday, so I came back for the next episode.
Thank you.
Well, I guess it's a, on one hand, we've been up to see how Columbus has been used to teach morality to us. Mm-hmm. And then I'm also interested how revisionism teaches us our culpability and the ideological, what's the word I want, intention behind the latter.
Okay. The ideological intention behind?
This, upon historical revisionism.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, on one hand, American history has been taught make Americans moral, quote-unquote, and much of revisionist history is looking at our culpability, and I'm not sure that I like that.
Okay, so let's try to sort through that as we go on in the four in the next four sessions. Two comments on things that people said. Who mentioned wanting to get materials and resources related to, I would say that this series will be based on a book called The American Journey, which is an action reflection process that you can buy in the bookstore. Also, I've got a lot of materials back here that I am not connected with other than that I deeply respect them. And there are order forms and some materials there, especially for school teachers. One thing about what you said, Carol, we are repeating one text from last week, but using it in a slightly different way, and it's the Journeys Across the Sea, which is today. And that's the only text that's repeated. Okay. Let's move into some information to begin with then. Having looked yesterday again, and remember those of you who were here, a slideshow. And the slideshow showed pictures and words about Columbus. Columbus usually being affiliated with God, and pictures of Columbus being clean and good, and the native people all looking alike and being mute and dumb and pagan. I'd like us to do a little bit of reading. This is from some materials developed by Church World Service of the National Council of Churches. And this is, the first page that I'd like us to read here is just some information about Columbus in his own time. There are some paragraphs that I've segmented out, and if you could, I'll read the headings, and then if you could just read what's in a box, and then pass it on to the next person, okay? The first quote I'll read, it's a quote from a 1991 advertisement promoting trade opportunities in Bolivia. And the ad simply says, "The conquest isn't over." Okay, let's start with, the title here is Vanishing Peoples.
Columbus' impression of the first people he encountered, the Arawak, they invite you to share
this anything. This is quote, right? Quote.
Thing. Quote. "They invite you to share anything they possess and show us much love. How easy it would be to convert these people and make them work for us." In less than a century, all 250,000 Arawak people of Hispaniola were dead from disease, slavery, and repression. The native population of the Americas dropped by 94% between 1492 and 1892. In the hemisphere as a whole, two of every three tribes were wiped out during the first 400 years.
You want to pass it on? The title here is Causes of Depopulation.
Disease, especially smallpox, measles, diphtheria. Epidemics wiped out whole villages, not always by accident. In 1763, Sir Geoffrey Amherst, commander-in-chief of British forces in Pennsylvania, wrote, quote, "You do well to inoculate the Indians with smallpox by means of blankets, as well as every other method that can serve to extirpate this execrable race." Let me read that again. I really botched that quote.
Sure.
"You do well to inoculate the Indians with smallpox by means of blankets, as well as every other method that can serve to extirpate this execrable race."
That was a 1763 quote. I think it was the Cherokee that were given blankets with smallpox virus or bacteria, intentionally given. Okay, still under causes of depopulation?
warfare, 19th century North America saw the worst instances. For example, in California, the native population declined by two-thirds in only 10 years, from 100,000 to 35,000, largely due to violence. That was 19th century, that was 1800s. What was the, do you know what the, were there battles, or what was the, that's less than 100 years ago.
I can't give you information about specific battles and specific tribes. I wish I could.
Removal and relocation. In 19th century USA, more than 100,000 Native Americans were forced west of the Mississippi. In the Trail of Tears, 10,000 Cherokee perished during the forced march, their forced march. This amounted to 50% of the population.
Okay, still under causes of depopulation?
Destruction of way of life, forced removals, and the destruction of the flora and fauna, the decimation of the buffalo, for example, eroded the foundation of Native culture.
Mission efforts. California's Chumash shrank from 70,000 to 15,000 in Franciscan mission settlements. After the gold rush of 1849, they died out completely.
And now we move into a slightly different subject, go on passing it. The birth of the slave trade.
Let me read this whole box.
If you would, loudly.
Trade in slaves between Europe and Africa preceded the discovery of the Americas. Enslavement of the Native American population began with Columbus, who captured
indigenous
people as translators and concubines. As gold continued to elude him, he turned increasingly to slavery to prove the profitable nature of his adventure. Columbus's effort at slaving failed. Too many died at sea. With a rapid depopulation of the native labor force, the Spanish and later the English and French turned to Africa. Over the 400 years of the slave trade, some 12 million Africans were enslaved. Nearly 10 million reached the Americas. Most of the rest died en route.
And now another section called Golden Dreams. Go ahead.
Imperial powers have been pumping wealth out of the Americas for nearly five centuries. Columbus forced the Taino Indians in Hispaniola to bring him an ounce of gold every 3 months. Those who didn't had their hands chopped off while escapees were hunted down with dogs. Despite these desperate measures, Columbus never found his El Dorado. Between 1500 and 1650, 180 to 200 tons of American gold were added to the European treasury, worth an estimated $2.8 billion in today's terms.
Thank you. That's the end of that box, isn't it?
Yes.
Let me just pass this to you. It's a piece we've been reading since you stepped in with it.
Let me simply ask, what, if anything, on that, of those readings surprise you?
The blankets. That just sounds gross. I mean, they were thinking so hard of ways to trick people into being killed that they thought that was more humane to make sure these blankets were infected and then trade them off so the people would die off.
I don't know if they thought it was more humane.
It was just a lot safer. He didn't have to be there.
Yeah, it really sounds sick then.
It's just spreading infection. Those blankets were never laundered or anything, and from the dead, they would take those blankets and give them as gifts to the Indians.
Right.
Except that it wasn't just as gifts, it was intentionally giving small
blankets. Well, they meant to do it.
Yes.
What's the movie that's not Dances with Wolves, but is about a priest that tries to
Black Rope.
Isn't that business of the smallpox epidemic in that? I think it.
I'm not sure.
I haven't seen the movie. I just saw the.
I've seen the movie. I read the book. That's about the Hurons in Canada and the Jesuits.
I read the book. I think it's in the book.
But regardless, that issue of smallpox blankets is surprising. Other things that are of surprise?
The exacting for gold. I mean, I think that it seems to me that any of those kinds of terrible punishments are so I mean, even there are a couple in Leviticus that are so stupid, because how's a person going to work without a hand? I can't imagine that you'd be so dumb as to do that kind of inhumane thing, just from a practical standpoint, let alone a moral standpoint. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes. You know, I think the first time that I had a little bit different view of our history was there was a series on television, many years ago now, with Alistair Cook about America, history of it. Mm-hmm. And then I just remember the one quote, it was about converting an Indian population to Christian. And they had the chief of the Indian tied to a stake, threatening to burn him unless he would convert to Christianity. Mm-hmm. And he said he didn't want to be a Christian because he was afraid that if he was, he would go to their heaven. Mm-hmm. It would be full of people like us.
Oh.
Wow. And that must be 15 years ago or more when I was on TV. Mm-hmm. And I suppose maybe that was the first time you get a feeling that there's more to history than what you've been told.
Yeah. Good. Anything else? Or let me phrase another question to you. Just the kinds of feelings that you feel in reading those statements.
Revulsion? Is that a word?
That's
that's
a word,
revulsion.
Yeah, revulsion. Anyone else?
Sad.
Inhuman.
Also a little embarrassing. You know, this country that we're so proud of.
Yeah.
That has this kind of history.
I don't think it then. Those kind of excesses or terrible things are not just a part of European culture.
Mm-hmm.
They're an American culture. They're a part of cultures throughout the world. And man's inhumanity to their own people is recorded around the world.
Okay.
So we shouldn't think of it just in us.
Mm-hmm. In us is the only place we can really do much about it, but we shouldn't think of it as exclusively us.
Right.
Yeah. Can you think about ways in which, move to a different kind of subject, a different kind of question, ways in which the dynamics of 1492, some of which we just looked at, some of which we looked at yesterday, occur today in our country? Can you think of a... Let me move to a different question. Chalk that one for a minute. Think for a minute about the beliefs that enabled that to happen, some of what we've just talked about. Think back about the slides, too. And maybe it's a tough question. To me, it's a critical question. It's something, again, for those of you who were here last week, it's also a question that I raised last week, and I forgive for repeating, or I beg forgiveness for repeating, but to me, it's without asking this question, we can't discuss the quincentenary. But the question of what are beliefs that enable those kinds of things to happen? Maybe to prime the pump a little bit, I'll offer one. Just the belief that, going back to the slideshow yesterday, the belief that God is on our side. And I would just suggest that belief was probably one that helped enable people to do what they did. God's on our side. We're converting these heathens. Of course we're going to burn them at the stake. If that's the way we can convert them, we can convert them. Can you think of any other beliefs? Yes.
I think it kind of goes along with it, that we're always right and that people are going to be just a lot better off doing things our way.
Okay, that's a good point. We're right.
The people should be like us.
Okay. I can't write on the big paper because I'm afraid it'll go through. No, it doesn't go through. All right, we're okay. We're right. And what did you say before? People should be like, people will be better off doing things the way we do.
Okay. And they want to be, for their own good.
Mm-hmm. Better off doing things our way.
That is more than that. Mm-hmm. It's not that we think we're right, it's we think we're superior.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So therefore, it doesn't make any difference whether people do things our way. And we don't want them to be like us. We want some slave trade to exploit.
When you say we there...
I'm including myself in the white race.
Okay, so white people think white people are superior, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, even like missionaries, I don't think we necessarily, when we go to preach Christianity, it's not because we want them to enslave them, it's because we think
we can save their souls.
I don't know.
Okay. Well, I think so. Part of it is superior, I think, is because we think we are educated, and therefore they are not, and therefore we should control.
So we think our education is superior?
Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, they're even less human than we.
Okay.
Who said that?
I said that.
Okay, they are, people of color are less human than people who are white. Okay. Others? I'm sorry about this pain, folks. Can you read?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Won't play through.
No, that's my main concern, but I don't think it is.
No.
Okay. Any others?
From the perspective of the Europeans, that they're kind of thinking the world was for their taking. Imperialism was everything, and taking over anything they could.
Okay.
Making it part of the kingdom and returning. Treasures to the royalty and
bonds. Okay. The world was for their taking. Actually, in terms of returning treasuries to the royalty, Columbus swung a deal with the king and queen whereby large percentages of the treasures actually went to him rather than to the royalty. And that was hereditary, meaning that for the rest of time, a percentage of what came from the New World would go to Columbus' sons. But still, your point is very well taken, that the world was for their taking.
Well, didn't a lot of that go to the church? Wasn't the church a tremendous power behind Columbus?
Was the church a tremendous financial power behind Columbus?
Well, but a moral power, too. I mean, anything, if he was in front of God with his banner, he was right.
Okay, that's a good point, that you're saying that whatever he did, if he did it in the name of God, was okay.
Therefore, everybody else agrees.
Anything done in the name of God? Okay. Others. Someone back here brought up
a strong moral imperative in that day and age to do something in the name of God.
Okay.
In fact, there was a papal bull, which in fact ensured that people, and I should say ensured, encouraged folks to enslave Africans and people of color. Just prior to Columbus, through the Portuguese, and the Portuguese were supposed to do this. Certainly others picked it up in the European, in wars.
So a moral imperative.
Yes. Because these savages lack God.
Are you saying a moral imperative to enslave people of color or to convert people of color?
Both.
Okay.
If it was necessary. Because it became a curiosity in Lisbon, it became something that you do is to have a African slave.
Okay, and that's something that we alluded to in the reading too about the slave trade between Europe and Africa beginning before the conquest of the Americas. Someone else, I think it was you, said something at the tail end of one of your statements about when you mentioned education, we think our education is superior, and you said, and therefore we have the right to control. And I'd like to pull something out of that, just looking at this, what was believed about the right to resources, or the right to land?
There's something really strange about the notion of conquest as being you kind of go in and stake your claim on the ground as though that made it yours. And most of the indigenous people that I've been in contact with, and that has to be New Guinea, they don't own land. The land sort of belongs to the tribe, but they can sell. Somebody came in and staked out a claim. There's something really strange about our notions of land ownership.
Might is right.
Might is right.
You can go in and take it, nobody can stop it, it's ours.
Might is right, and then what you're saying, Carol, is a specific example of that might gives the right to land. And maybe we could say to economic resources.
I think she was saying, though, there's a difference in view of who owns land that different cultures have. And of course, from the Old Testament there, it was sort of, they felt it was unfair, but to restore fairness, they would try to every 50 years give it to the last prior owner. But they figured out ways around that too. There, in that culture, land was associated with people, whereas some of the cultures, it was not. And in this country, it was not. I mean, that was, they didn't have fences and posts and say, this is mine. It was.
Okay, so the belief that land can be owned?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. All right, I'm going to throw out two others because I want to move on. I'm going to throw out the notion, what time did we start? 4 o'clock, okay, all right, we're all right. I'm going to throw out another notion, and that is that some people exist for the profit of other people. In other words, the native people that Columbus encountered, he saw as existing for the profit of the Europeans. In other words, to get them gold or to be enslaved. Can be owned. Pardon me?
That noise really gets too.
Does it grate on your nerves here? I think it's the orange one then. I'm glad you told me. I know that noise is good. Well, given, now, what we've talked about those as beliefs that enabled what I'm terming the conquest, and I'm using that term coming out of the term that Native peoples use for the coming of the Europeans. I'd like to suggest, and there are many terms that we could use other than beliefs. We could use assumptions. I'm going to use the term cultural myths or ideologies, ways of believing that are assumed, probably not questioned, and that run life. And some of these beliefs enabled and enabled the coming of the Europeans to the Americas. I hate to use the word encounter. And I know that's a popular neutral term to use about the encounter between the cultures, but you know, in my mind, I think if someone barged into your house and raped you and then killed your kids, would you call that an encounter? And so I just don't like to use the term encounter in talking about the coming about this period of time. I do want to raise the other question now that I had alluded to earlier. And maybe it's a more difficult question, I'm not sure, but it's the question of where we might see these myths or these belief systems at work today. And could we think about that a little bit? Maybe not taking just one, but look at all of them and see if you can think of places where you see those at work today or in recent history.
The U.S. assuming that it had the right to use an atoll for nuclear experimentation of bombs and just sort of moving people off of it and saying you'll adapt well to this other place. Okay.
Moving people off the island, you mean?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, that's an interesting example. Okay. Other examples. Good.
A lot of, there's reasons that I've gone to war every time too, that we think we know what's right, and
okay.
We're on the, you know, Persian Gulf or wherever.
Okay.
We think we're right.
Okay, good. That brings to mind the slide that we saw yesterday that was a bit controversial. Quayle's quote about the Persian Gulf War, saying, the question is God on our side? I think he is. Yes.
Well, there's another interesting parallel. The first things I heard about, or the things I know of, Columbus's first trip was, I didn't remember, but it says that he took 5 slaves back from that one. But that one was a more exploratory or a idealistic type trip. But the subsequent trips were all to bring booty home. I mean, it was flat out economic. But somehow in that situation, it was maintained by lifting it up as, you know, a moral imperative. In modern times, we do the same thing. It usually is some economic motivation that really gets us into these situations, but not always. But
for example,
they are like oil in the Middle East. I mean, but But you can usually, if you, and you usually don't have to work very hard because there's sin everywhere. You can find some excuse to cloak your claim.
Okay.
And you do that. And it's,
what's happening in Yugoslavia?
But let me just respond quickly that's a very good point. That in modern time it might be an economic imperative, but it's cloaked in moral language.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, in Europe, what's happened? One country, Yugoslavia. The fighting they're doing there, when it's going to be mine.
Okay, good. Any others? Dig into your own, think about your own neighborhoods, your own cities.
I was thinking, even when we talk about our, we've been here, our education is the period for so long, mm-hmm. Children who moved into the country were automatically taught, we only speak English in our uh-huh. classroom. We wouldn't encourage your other cultural.
Okay.
Now they're drawing it out more, and some bilingual programs mm-hmm. and such, but mm-hmm. usually they're told to just forget your culture, mm-hmm. you know, absorb mm-hmm. ours.
Mm-hmm. Good. It's true. Think about the one, I'm not sure who said it, but white people see white people as superior. Can you think of examples of that?
I was thinking yes. about in the area where we live, we have several reservations mm-hmm. for Indians. And mm-hmm. and I think about how we think of them as mm-hmm. being lazy and maybe there's more alcoholism, mm-hmm. That houses are different and mm-hmm. somehow it all looks different and seems mm-hmm. to, and we have this idea that they're less mm-hmm. less than. Mm-hmm.
And they belong on the reservation.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. I think we do, on some level, have this idea that they are less than. And maybe part of that is failing to hear their own story or their
sure.
own reality.
Yeah.
And just to think about alcohol. Why, you know, why is alcohol isn't such an issue. Who brought alcohol?
Right.
And what an alcoholism can be a response to absolute devastation. And who has done the devastating that led people to alcohol. But I think that's a very good point, yes.
The alcohol is equivalent to the smallpox.
Interesting.
It's
yeah.
disease.
Yeah. 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 Other examples, yes.
Yeah, I'm interested. In most cultures of this type,
yes.
Some of the greedy people, the natives would mm-hmm. participate in some of these things too, mm-hmm. with the Spanish. I assume that happened here too.
Say more what you mean with the Spanish. I didn't get what you meant by that.
Well, the people would sell their own people as slaves and things like that, just to... The Indians would sell their own people as slaves for the Spanish. Most cultures, and I'm thinking of all the wars we've been in lately.
Uh-huh. Collude. Hmm. You mean most cultures will have segments of the culture that moves over to be on the side of the powers that are coming in?
Well, I won't say they move over to the side uh-huh. that's coming in. They're, uh-huh. they're just greedy enough to
I think that's absolutely
what I meant
true.
I said there's sin everywhere. Yes. If you look, you can find an excuse.
Yes.
People,
yes. And
that doesn't excuse the Spanish.
No, but your point is well taken, and we would be very foolish, and totally foolish to in some way romanticize the indigenous cultures that were here as totally mm-hmm. innocent or totally... pure or good. That's not a point that I'm trying to make at all. I wouldn't make that point.
No,
yeah. Good. Yes.
What about the way, like, I guess average Americans view the inner cities right now,
mm-hmm.
you know, this summer, mm-hmm. with the riots that were taking mm-hmm. place, and mm-hmm. you know, the video images of that, and the way people kind of thought of that as those people, mm-hmm. that area, their problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like not in our nice suburban area, but mm-hmm. over there, that's mm-hmm. taking place.
I think that's a good example, and I would bet that on some level most of us somehow think that because of that we're a little bit better than. We wouldn't stoop
right.
to that, or we're a little bit better than. Any other examples? I think that's a really important one, the number two, that white people seeing white people as superior, and treating white people as superior. Or I would add maybe not only superior, but as more trustworthy, as more honest. I could throw out a couple of examples from my own life of late. I live in a city that's very, very mixed, definitely. I live in Washington, D.C., and I was driving down my street the other day, maybe a month ago, and in front of one house there was a group of men standing, and I was instantly suspicious. I mean, my first reaction was, what's going on, what kind of drug stuff is happening. The men were all black. And I knew that the minute I saw them, before I had my response. And then the next second, I heard my response. And I thought, had that been a group of white men, four white men standing in front of the house, would I have responded that way? And I don't think that I would have. Which to me was a statement of kind of the inherent trust of white people over, perhaps over people of color.
Well, and where I live too, we have a lot of migrants come in and work in the fields and the berries and stuff, and there's some housing developments where they stay, you know, and people stay away from that area. I mean, we suspect that the crime is a result of the migrants coming in, and it's a shame, you know, but I know that happened.
Right. Let's look at a couple of other, and I won't pursue this for a lot longer, but I firmly believe that many of these things that we've named that enabled the conquest of the Americas enable ongoing oppression of marginalized peoples. Look at the one we talked about, might is right, or including the right to land and resources. And maybe here I define might as military might, but also economic might, economic power.
Or technological. I'm convinced that is a great deal of technological sophistication, which automatically means that, in interpretation, that the person that's more technologically advanced is therefore superior. They always win, and it doesn't even consider that maybe the value system of the victim is better.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, I think all kinds of places in third world countries where we've gone in and sort of duped people into giving us things. I saw that nicely in New Guinea when I was there after World War II. Fortunately, we weren't the bad guys right then, but the Japanese came in and kind of tricked them out of a lot of their natural resources, especially hardwoods.
Okay.
And then they spend a lot of time trying to figure out ways stopping that leak. And I think we've done the same thing in the Amazon, say, if the jungle disappears. Why? Because we're looking for fancy medical stuff, but it's to benefit us and not to them.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Technological might makes right also. Yeah. A couple of others that I might bring up just in terms of Native peoples here. The issue of Native lands and the use of Native lands. There are, I think, 20,000 Hopi and Navajo peoples that have been removed from their reservation lands in recent years because of the minerals on that land that mining interests want. And to me, that's a very distinct example of might, economic might, makes right. Another example that I read about, and I'll read it from this also. This is a little bit more indirect, but disease being still a killer. One group of Indians in South America, 15,000 at the beginning of the century, now number more than 200 due to contact with unknown bacteria brought by North Americans, a process now speeded up by Dow Chemical's defoliants. I don't need to read that, I can just say it. Another, to me, an example of might makes right is the use of labor in this country but particularly in Central America and Latin America, internationally owned companies using labor and using insecticides that are outlawed in this country, absolutely forbidden, but using them there, and they're being sprayed on the people, and people literally dying. Or in Honduras, the women working in the banana plantations, you know, obviously for our bananas, Dole bananas and standard fruit, the women have to stand. I worked as a missionary in Honduras for 2 years, but the women have to stand in chemically water on the ground to process the bananas and begin to have the skin peel off their feet. But to me, that's an example, not of a horror story, not only of a horror story, but of might makes right, because it's economic interest of having cheap bananas that means they have to do the production in the cheapest way possible, which means the women have to lose their feet. Yes?
Well, the one you just bring up, this multinational corporation, is sort of an insidious thing that is here right now in our where they are not responsible to any country, not even the country they come from. Because if they are to meet their responsibility, they are to, if you will, optimize or maximize their profits. Mm-hmm. And that's what they would be told to do, go to where the labor is cheapest and the restrictions make that possible.
Good.
And our laws permit that. If we said that we couldn't import anything that was that didn't meet our same standards, that would stop it. But but that would not be in our in their economic interest. That's the tension that's here.
So that's another excellent example of economic interest coming over the human need. And we could go on for 2 weeks, you know, digging into and bringing up examples. I'd like us to move a little bit, but I'd like to just kind of encapsulate that by saying simply that to look at the story of Columbus coming here and to look at the atrocities there and all of the things we've talked about and named is not as important in itself as it is to move us into looking at where the same thing is happening here and now by our own people. Because by naming those places, by naming those beliefs, and by naming those incidences, then we can begin to build alternatives. You wanted to say another comment.
Yeah, I was before I forget, on the Minus Right thing, I was thinking of one thing we hadn't talked about, and that's kind of mass communication, popularized American culture, how we can spread that throughout the world and make people think the image we have, the lifestyles we live, is being the correct lifestyle, the control we have over international communication, CNN. And it's almost like we, to a large extent, we can control what a lot of people see and hear and read in the world.
That's a very, very good point, and it kind of goes back up to here to saying we're right and people would be better off doing things our way. Good, but we've got increased power to do that with mass
kind of
communication. Yep. I'd like to move us. We've looked at one journey. We've looked at the journey of Columbus representing the Europeans to the Americas. Let's look at another journey. Look into the Book of Mark and look at the stories of the sea crossings, the boats, the sea crossings that Christ called his disciples to in the Book of Mark. And again, as I said, we did use this text in the first series last week, but I want to repeat it from a different angle because I think it's the crux of what we'll be talking about. I'm having three people read this text dramatically out loud. While you listen, I'd invite you to play the role of the disciples. Be the disciples in this text. Maybe close your eyes and notice images, words, feelings that strike you in the hearing of the text. Okay. We have a narrator, and we have Jesus, and we have the disciples. The narrator is in pink. The disciples, aren't you the disciples?
Sorry.
You're the, and Jesus is in the back. Okay. Go ahead.
That day, as evening drew on, he said to them,
"Let us cross over to the farther shore."
Leaving the crowd, they took him away in the boat in which he was sitting, while the other boats accompanied him. It happened that a bad squall blew up. The waves were breaking over the boat, and it began to ship water badly. Jesus was in the stern through it all, sound asleep on a cushion. They finally woke him up and said to him,
"Teacher, does it not matter to you that we are going to drown?"
He awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea,
"Quiet, be still."
The wind fell off, and everything grew calm. Then he said to them,
"Why are you so terrified? Why are you lacking in faith?"
A great awe overcame them at this. They kept saying to one another,
"Who can this be that the wind and the sea obey him?"
Immediately afterward, he insisted that his disciples get into the boat and precede him to the other side toward Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd.
Could I make a quick comment here? You just started on the second boat crossing. So I would just like to say that what you just heard was the boat crossing from Mark 4. And now we'll start to hear again in Mark 6 another story of a journey across the sea in a boat.
Immediately afterward, he insisted that his disciples get into the boat and precede him to the other side toward Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. When he had taken leave of them, he went off to the mountain to pray. As evening drew on, the boat was far out on the lake while he was alone on the land. Then, seeing them tossed about as they tried to row with the wind against them, he came walking toward them on the water. The time was between 3 and 6 in the morning. He meant to pass them by. When they saw him walking on the lake, they thought it was a ghost and they began to cry out. They had all seen him and were terrified. He hastened to reassure them.
"Get a hold of yourselves. It is I. Do not be afraid."
He got into the boat with them, and the wind died down. They were taken aback by these happenings, for they had not understood about the loaves. On the contrary, their minds were completely closed to the meaning of the events.
Okay, come back from first century Palestine. And images that struck you, feelings, words, questions? How do you think the disciples might have felt in that crossing?
I think they were afraid.
Mm-hmm. Afraid? Okay. Any parallels you noticed between the texts, the two texts? A couple of parallels that I'd like to point out. One being the common destination. In both of these texts, they are going to the other side, to the other side of the sea. Another parallel being that the wind, a fierce storm, came up in both. Another being that in both cases, the disciples were afraid, and Jesus calmed their fears and called them to faith. And another being that they were all astounded. I'm a little trapped by time. So I'm going to, rather than talking more about the text, I'd like to, or rather than having us break into small groups and talk about the text, I'd like to just present some thoughts about the text. There are 6 boat crossings in Mark. Only 2 of them are narrated in such a lengthy fashion as this one. But one could interpret the text, and could interpret these boat crossings as having 2 particular purposes in the book of Mark. One being having symbolic purpose in themselves, but the other being to hold together the complex narrative of this book. The book of Mark can be seen as being divided into 2 halves, 2 different cycles, one occurring in Jewish land and the other on the other side, generally on the other side of the sea in Gentile land. The Gentiles being obviously an other people than the Jews. Each of those cycles parallels, mirrors each other with parallel scenes of healings, of exorcisms, of teachings, of Jesus' prophetic confrontation with the authorities, and with feedings in the wilderness of masses of people with very little food. To look at that text, I think we need to look at the historical context, and that being the first century Palestine and the honor codes, the purity codes and the honor system that dictated life in that time and in that culture. People were delineated into specific categories and specific roles. The purity codes were very exclusionary. There was the pure and the impure. Men were pure, women were impure. The rich were pure, the poor were impure, because the poor did not have the economic means to carry out the rites that established purity, to carry out the rites of washing the food and washing the jugs and washing the kettles. Those who were not whole or who were outcasts were impure, compared to those who were whole and who were pure. And Jesus, constantly throughout the book of Mark, is overturning those codes, the purity codes and the honor system. Jesus touches the woman that he should not have touched, the bleeding woman. He speaks with women. He eats with outcasts. He defends his disciples not washing hands or not washing the kettles and the jugs before eating. In other words, he overturns, he shatters the codes of society in his day that excluded, the codes of society that created boundaries, boundaries between the rich and the poor, boundaries between the pure and the impure. One can see the boat crossings as symbolic of Jesus inviting the disciples to cross over to the other side, to the other people, the Gentile territory, and not just to remain in their own land with their own people. Interestingly enough, each time Jesus invites the disciples to cross over, they are faced with enormous difficulties on the sea, practically death-rending difficulties. And each time, Christ commands not to fear and that Christ's presence is there. So we could see the book of Mark and including these 2 stories as a way of Jesus bringing in a kingdom that is not exclusionary and that does not keep people with one's own people. And that the discipleship journey in his time involved breaking away and shattering through codes of exclusion. Many of these being codes of exclusion in our own day. Jesus ends both of these texts with something to the effect of, "Take heart, it is I am with you." And so to close, I would like to, and in application of this text, I would like to give a bit of a homework assignment. And that assignment would be for you to take a few minutes, briefly, and to meditate on a couple of questions. And one of them would be thinking of an invitation that has been before you to cross over to the other side of humanity. And by that I mean to marginalized people, to Native American people, to poor people, to people who in your community are marginalized. In your community that might be people who are differently abled. But think of an invitation that has been before you to cross over. And then think of the winds and the storms that terrify you and that may keep you from crossing over. And then think about where God has been present in that. I offer that as an assignment to take out with you from this time today. Briefly, tomorrow we'll talk about the exorcisms, exorcising the demon from the demoniac of Gerasene. Thank you for being here. And this is the beginning of the conversation. We'll talk more.